Welcome to the Songs of Note podcast, where we talk about the songs we love and the stories behind them. I'm your host, Ryan Gregg. I'm really excited today to be talking with my friend, Ryan Howell. Ryan used to do sound. He ran sound a couple times for my band, but also ran sound at the church where I went, and I would play in the group there sometimes, and we get to know each other a little bit that way. But I posted about recently on my Instagram about the new Dave Grohl autobiography that just came out. And I said, has anybody read this thing? I really want to talk about it. And he wrote right back and was like, yeah, it's awesome. And so I was really excited to get to talk to a buddy of mine about Dave Grohl's autobiography. My thought was, you guys might be looking for something to get for Christmas or to give for Christmas. And this is a great book. I listened to it on Audible, but there's also the hard copy, obviously, that you can read. But it was really good. So this is just a discussion about the book. There will be many spoilers. So if you don't want to know what's going to happen to the book, don't listen. But I thought it was really fun and a cool episode, and I just love the book. So if you have not subscribed, don't forget to subscribe, and hope you enjoy the interview. Here we go.
Well, Ryan, thanks so much for coming on the show today to talk about Dave Grohl. I'm glad to chat with you.
Appreciate you having me.
Yeah, man. Okay, so the way that this kind of lined up was I was loving this book, loving the Dave Grohl autobiography, listening to it on Audible, and then I posted to Instagram, who else has read this thing? Is anybody liking this thing? And then you and I have known each other for a number of years, and you said you'd read it, so that's kind of how we got connected to talk about it today. So I don't know about your, like, growing up and how you first, you know, became aware of Nirvana and Dave Grohl and all that. Can you tell me when you first did become aware of him and the band?
Yeah, my first memory of Nirvana was when they were on Saturday Night Live. And I just knew I saw something and heard something that I'd never seen or heard before. I bought the cassette like the next day.
Nice. You know, that reminds me of my memory was being in a carpool, and this is going to age me. I think I was in elementary school, and I'm pretty sure we were listening to Fresh Prince on cassette, or Will Smith or something like that. And then this came out. This is what I remember following it. And I was like, what?
Wow.
Those are very different sounds. So Dave Grohl to me is an interesting guy. And I'm curious if you think of him in the same way that I do. It felt like, first off, he was the drummer for Nirvana. He was the guy with the hair flying, and he just knew he was awesome at drums. But it seemed like once he got in the Foo Fighters, it just seemed like he was ushered into this level of like rock royalty, of like Bruce Springsteen level people, of just, it seemed like he was embraced by that community. Did you feel that at all? Like when you look at him and look at how people talk about him or refer to him?
I certainly saw it on the outside. I was a somewhat slow adopter to Foo Fighters because I had put him in a box, and he didn't meet my criteria for who I thought he needed to be and what that music needed to be. But I quickly started listening to it. But it took me a little bit to turn on to Foo Fighters and this new project.
Okay, so that was similar for me. When you analyze what you felt about it when it first came through, do you remember your feelings about Foo Fighters and with him being the front man?
Yeah, I so initially I was this angsty, you know, grungy teenager, and Foo Fighters was not, at least the first album for sure, did not have that. It had a more kind of poppy sound to it. Mm-hmm. So I think that's part of why I rejected it. And then the other piece was like, I just hadn't seen in my life to that point a musician move from an instrument that he was so well known for to being a front man. So yeah. I guess it was just skepticism. I don't know. I mean, I was a dumb teenager at the time, so I don't know that I've analyzed that too much.
Well, that's funny because I had similar feelings. I haven't talked about this before, and we weren't planning on talking about it, but I'm thinking through it. I remember when somebody showed me the Foo Fighters' first album, and I was like, what? He's the singer? Like, I remember feeling skeptical, too. And I feel like they've proved me wrong over time in the fact that they're still around, and they've done so many great songs. But I feel really skeptical, too. And that's a good point about there was no model for somebody going from, like, drums to singer, not, or like, I guess Phil Collins did that way, you know, back in the 80s and stuff like that. But that's not Don Henley. Right. But that's not front of mind for the 90s groups. Well, so yeah. the book is full of good stories, and you and I both listened to it on Audible, where for people listening, Dave Grohl is the guy reading the book. So it's worth it just to hear him say these words, because he brings so much life to the book. And there's so many stories. So if you had to think of like one that stuck out, one favorite, is there one that comes to mind for you?
Yeah, there were several, but the one that I had this like put myself in Dave Grohl's shoes moment was, he's on tour, and I guess maybe we should say spoiler alert here.
Whole episode is going to be spoiler alerts. And you know what? For people listening, the whole idea in this was like, we'd love to talk about the book and say what we liked about it, but I think no matter what we talk about, he's going to do a better job of describing it. So yeah, full of spoiler alerts. Go ahead.
All right. So he's on tour with Scream, pretty fresh out of it, like hitting the road, leaving high school, and he's in Canada. I think it was Toronto. And he's sitting outside. Turns out they're like opening for Iggy Pop, who's going to have a CD release party like that evening.
Yes.
And so they've got to get out of soundcheck early so Iggy and his entourage can be in the room. And they're
they thought they were going to get to hang and hear the show, and they were even ushered out of the building, right? They weren't even going to get to hear the warm up. Yeah, get out of here.
That's right. So they're like killing time in a city that isn't their own, and smoking cigarettes and trying to take naps in their van, which of course he's got a ton of stories about vans too, but the security detail or somebody comes out and says, "Hey, where's the drummer for the band?" And he like raises his hand, afraid that he's like, what going through his head? What did I do? Like, this isn't the first time somebody's looked for me.
Right.
Who would be mad at me? And they're like, come inside. So he's like, meets Iggy Pop, and he's like, what songs do you know? And he's like, all of them.
That's so great.
They start jamming together. I mean, I think he's what, 18 or 19 at
he's
the time?
He's a teenager. Yeah.
And so when I heard that, I just had to think, my goodness, like, to be an 18 or 19 year old and meet one of your all time rock heroes face to face, and then be asked to jam. And then it turns out he doesn't have any rhythm section for this CD release concert. So then they invite the bass player too to come in, and they do the show with Iggy Pop. It was,
I love that.
Yeah.
That is the musician dream come true, is they need my rock star. Hero needs me. And it actually happened to him. Yeah, it is a teenager. That's incredible.
Yeah.
Okay, so I love that one. And you know what I like about the whole thing is, like, Dave has interacted with everybody. Beatles, I mean, all these people. And I love the way when he talks about it, he is like in awe of the fact that he gets to be around them. And I think he even described it as getting to interact with the people you've seen in a museum your whole life. Like, he described that in some way where it goes from being something you were observing to something you were experiencing in real time and interacting with you. I thought that was so cool. When you think about like of the stories he told, were there any that jumped out and surprised you in the book?
You know, I think it was more a surprise of omission. You know, going back to the whole Nirvana story, Dave Grohl for me and probably many others was defined as being a part of Nirvana, and Nirvana it's a very short part of the book.
It really is,
which it gave me great appreciation for Dave Grohl, the man. He wasn't just a, this grunge icon for a few years in the 90s. He had a beginning that was, I guess we'll call that the middle, and he's still in, in the end part. Yeah. So, as a musician and as a man, he's not just defined by, that one association of Nirvana or Kurt Cobain. He's so much more.
Yeah, that's a good takeaway too, because it's easy to, and you can see when he talks about himself as like, I didn't want to be that guy from Nirvana. I wanted to have my own thing. And he does, and he goes and he talks not only about what he did with the band, but also with starting a family and having kids. And let's talk about the Nirvana thing for a minute. So I pulled a quote from there was a review of the book from the Washington Post. And in talking about Cobain, because he talks about him, but really, like you said, the amount of time that Nirvana was even a band was so short. Like, they were super popular for 2.5 years, like mainstream popular, about 2.5 years, maybe even less than that, from Huge to Cobain's death, which is super short in the life of a band. But the Washington Post review said Grohl's relationship to him, being Kurt Cobain, comes to resemble ours. He is both the center of Grohl's universe and an unknowable figure at its edges. And I thought, man, that is really interesting. Like, for David Grohl to have so much of his life shaped by this guy who did incredible work and who he respected, but he only knew in certain aspects. He didn't even fully know him. And I think that comes through in the book in the ways that he talked about him, how he was in relationship with him as far as working together, or they lived together. But he doesn't really go into much personal stuff about Cobain. I thought that was interesting. Did that strike you in the same way?
Yeah, you know, I did wonder if that was just... maybe he withheld some of the stories he wanted to tell out of respect for Kurt's memory, because, you know, I got the impression those were not the best of times in Nirvana. I mean, there was obviously strife amongst the band. And I mean, I don't know how there couldn't be when you rise, you know, to that level of notoriety so quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree. Okay. So the story, my favorite story in the book is about him. You know, he talks about how they were eating on, like, they had no money. Like, this is like Nirvana is recording. He's living with Kurt. They have, I think his first payment from Nirvana was like $600 or something. And that was the most money he'd ever seen in his life. But even on that, they're down to, I think he said, eating corn dogs 3 times a day from the gas station. It was something like that. It was like, oh, gross. And he talks about how Kurt had a turtle and how the whole place smelled so bad. And then, so he, correct me if I'm wrong, but what I remember is that he talks about getting, he's on tour with Nirvana and he's hungry and they don't have any money. And he goes to the hotel and a letter has arrived for him and he goes to open it and it's a credit card. Do you remember this story?
Oh yeah. Absolutely.
Can you tell that?
Yeah. I mean, he opens it up, has no idea what it is. And it's a credit card. And his first thought is like, oh my goodness, like he's never had that. I've got to test this thing. Didn't he test it in like the lobby store or something first?
Yeah, he got some sunglasses to like some baby blue sunglasses to match his rental car or something, which I was like, oh, that's fun. Yeah,
that's right.
And then he talks about how hungry he was and how he looks across the hotel lobby and through the doors, he sees the two best words he's ever seen. Benihana. and that's where he goes with his big credit card moment. But I thought that was an interesting perspective, especially when you hear about bands that are huge. The money doesn't immediately come a lot of times. And a lot of times those guys are down and out until they are huge. And that was certainly the case. When you look at Nirvana and then into the Foo Fighters, I mean, some of this is obvious, but how do you think being in Nirvana helped Dave in starting the Foo Fighters, and what do you think he like brought into that band as things that he might do the same and things he might do differently?
Yeah, I think that's part of the impression of his time with Scream. When he talks about that band and touring with them, they were friends. I mean, he goes into great length when he's making the decision to move to Seattle. So he already had a relationship with his bandmates that was beyond just people sharing a stage playing different roles. They were friends and had seen the world together. So he had a great impression. And then he goes to Nirvana, and that is what it was and made an impression on him. I got to believe that he, if given the opportunity, was going to try to take the best of both of those things, and primarily the friendship. I mean, I think he speaks of his friendship with Taylor Hawkins at a level that is like brotherhood before they were in a band together.
That's true.
They were at some festival together and met and were like bosom buddies from the start.
Right.
So to create a culture where he can have fun doing it, regardless of who he's with, I got to believe that was at the forefront of his mind.
I would think so too. And you're right. And he does talk about, I feel like he does a really good job of talking about the Foo Fighters in a way that like tips his hat to them throughout. Like he's like, you can tell he respects them and he's acknowledging them in different ways and the different contributions they've made, how they couldn't have been what they were without each of the players. But it also makes me think of Nirvana as like a dysfunctional relationship to the, in the way of like, that was a band that was fronted by one guy who was writing the songs. Fame took them to another level, and he was along for the ride. And it seems like with Foo Fighters, they were really intentional along the way to foster, like you said, relationships within that group, to work to make it feel like a family or a team or whatever you want to say. Like, it felt like that was something that was important to him along the way. I always thought that, like, I always thought that the Foo Fighters and Dave Grohl specifically were funny in the fact that he liked humor. What did you think about, like, the humor aspect of the book? He talks about liking Saturday Night Live as a kid, and you know, the Foo Fighters are known for all these funny videos. That was always funny to me about him, that he leaned into that, and people like that about him.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the videos, excuse me, for sure, where they seem to let their hair down. They just don't take themselves too seriously.
Yeah, he goes, I'm the weird breed of what do you say, loving comedy in music, or I don't remember how that went, but I remember when they first came out and had those videos, that, like, I've never liked comedy and music. That's something I really dislike. So I remember, like, I know some people love, like, Weird Al. And as soon as I saw them doing funny music videos, I was like, I don't know. I feel like that slowed my time to buy in. But I think that's just part of his personality. And he kind of talks about that. Do you have a favorite story in the book about, like, a favorite moment of Dave's experience with another rock star? Because he talks about all these great stories about famous people. Did any of those stick out to you?
Oh, yeah. I think one that stuck out that, oddly enough, you would never put the two together, is his story about Neil Diamond. So,
oh yeah, that was a great one.
He prefaces this whole section of the book with, like, there are some musicians that you're going to trip over your words, you're awestruck when you see them, and then there's others that were famous but they never made an impression on him, and Neil Diamond was one of those guys. But there was some event that he was going to be at that Neil Diamond was also going to be at or be honored at. I forget exactly how it came to pass, but again, just pointing to Dave Grohl's character, his high school friend died at an early age, and that guy's mother was a huge Neil Diamond fan. Mm-hmm. So he knew he was going to be in the same universe as Neil Diamond, invites her to come out to this award ceremony, yeah, and introduces the two, and then the woman ends up going home with literally the shirt off Neil Diamond's back that is studded in rhinestones.
That's right. And I appreciated the way that he phrased that too. Like, myself, like, I've never liked Neil Diamond. I don't like that kind of music, but I know I've got great friends that are like, Sweet Caroline's the best thing ever. I'm like, please don't let me ever hear it. But he, you know, I liked how he acknowledged that he never personally connected with it, but like you said, it still showed his character that he was able to see that his music meant a lot to a lot of people, and specifically to his friend's mother, his friend who had passed away, his mom. And that was so cool. I thought that was incredible, because, you know, that must have been a story that she's still telling.
Oh, for sure. What about you? What was yours?
So favorite story. I think I'm just such a huge Beatles fan, and I loved all the mentions of Paul McCartney, because, you know, it sounds like they end up becoming pretty good friends, at least to the fact that he's mentioning him multiple times throughout the book. But I think that one of my favorites was where he is out to dinner with his wife and his, or I guess they're going to go out to dinner. I think it was after the Grammys or something. And she texts and says, are you okay if AC/DC comes out to dinner? And he talks about how that, like, blew his mind. He's like, what? You know, and then it ends up being him and all these other people and AC/DC and Paul McCartney. And he ends up calling in, what, like a jazz band to come and surprise the whole restaurant. And they come and play in there. I thought that was, like, really fun. But the other story I really liked was the one about him, about Dave being at a toy store with his kids, and how they saw Barbies, and how he found a Pat Benatar Barbie, and he bought it. And then they were playing Madison Square Garden a couple of, like, weeks later, and they remembered that she lived in town. So he invited her to come play on stage, and then she ended up staying with his family for the weekend. And so his little girl comes up and asks, hey, will Pat read me bedtime stories? And, you know, the idea of Pat Benatar reading bedtime stories to your kid, I just thought was, man, that's surreal. Like, what in the world?
For sure.
There's so many stories that were like, that's amazing. I would have never known that or thought that. Let's talk about the stage incident, the injury. Have you seen the footage of when he fell off stage and broke his leg?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
It makes your stomach fall. I was showing my wife the other day and I was like, have you seen this? Cause the drop is real. I mean, I think he said it was 12 feet.
Yeah, I think so.
That was another one of my favorite stories, just about his, and I'll tell this story. So he talks about how they're playing this huge show. I mean, I don't remember how many people, there was thousands and thousands of people, and how he just wanted to kill it. And it is like song one, and he runs up to the edge of the stage and trips. And then he tells these stories about how he used to jump off houses when he was a kid and how he could totally land it and it was going to be fine. But when he landed this one, he felt it crack and he knew there was a problem and basically realized that he is out of commission. He thinks he broke his leg. He's on the floor. This concert has just started. The band is still playing and he's on the ground, and they get a doctor over and they're like, well, we can get you a cast, but it's going to be hours before you're back here. And he's like, no, I want up on that stage. And they basically go set him up, and didn't the doctor have to hold his leg in place on stage, yeah, or else it was going to come out of socket again, or whatever you describe that. Isn't that right? Where the guy had to be on stage with, yeah, him, like head down, holding it in place. Oh, it made my stomach drop too. I was like, oh, that just sounds so awful. But like, he went on to finish the show. Then they go and they get the big cast. And then he made that part of all those shows. I don't know if you saw those photos where he had like the throne made with a big thing for his leg to be outstretched for all these shows, so he could play sitting down, leg propped, and trying to make the best, yeah, of it. I thought that was awesome. That seemed like such
that a... That's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought that was so cool.
And the guy who was holding his foot at one point started nodding his head. Turned out he was a huge Foo Fighters fan or something.
That's right. That's right. I thought that was awesome.
Imagine that guy. Like, he's on stage in all of his EMT get up holding Dave Grohl's foot.
Places,
how weird.
Places you wouldn't have seen yourself when you woke up that morning. yeah. I thought that was great. What about the, like, all of the times when he talks about meeting presidents? I thought this is really interesting, in the fact that he had multiple White House visits, and he talks about even being conflicted with the politics of different presidents, but having to remember that he grew up on the other side of Washington and how, you know, it was such a huge honor and he was able to perform so many times and interact with all these presidents. It just seems surreal, mm-hmm, to hear him talk about Bush and Obama and all these different people he's meeting and playing music for as the featured guest or as involved at that level. And he's like, I'm just a kid who grew up loving rock music. What am I doing here?
Yeah.
What did he say? Hey, what did Bush say to him? He said, way to go, dude, or something like that. And yeah, I thought that was funny.
Well, and even how that story rolls into the story that just preceded that, where he's like going to give an award. Was it to Paul McCartney at the Kennedy Center on
it? Yeah. I think that was it.
And so somebody wrote this speech for him.
Oh,
and
yeah,
it's riddled with like rock speak, like dude speak, I think he calls
cliches.
It.
Cliches. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And he's like, I can't read this.
Right.
So he like concocts some better speech, you know, on the fly. And then the very next story is the president referring to him as dude, which is exactly what he avoided trying to say the whole time.
That was awesome. Yes. I love that. What about his mom? I feel like he just talked about his mom so much that it surprised me, to the fact that, like, I mean, it seemed like she was a really huge part of his life. What were your takeaways from the ways that he talked about his mom? Anything stick out to you?
Oh man. Yeah. I'm aware of the other book that his mother wrote about other mothers of rock musicians, yeah, but I haven't read that one.
I haven't either.
I think, you know, so she was an educator, single mom. You know, you got to believe, like, from her perspective, education is how her kids are going to, you know, leave the home and spread their wings. So she's a respected teacher. And then to have your son go and say, hey, I want to quit school and go hit the road at, what, 17 years old.
Yeah.
How selfless she needed to be to let him do that and experience it when I don't know if I'm in her shoes.
Gosh,
I would want him to finish his education.
Yeah, that'd be a hard thing to do.
Yeah.
You know, I thought, I think, go ahead, keep up.
Another story of when she took him to the jazz club in DC, where on like Sunday afternoons they had like an open mic and would let people just sign up and rotate in. And he was, I don't know, some early teenage kid in the midst of these, you know, jazz musicians who were accomplished in their own right. And he just sat up there and blew it, did one song, and then got off. But his mom was just glowing with pride.
That was awesome. Yeah. And he was like, he realized how embarrassing it was that he was going to go try to hang with these guys who were incredible jazz musicians, but his mom was pushing him to do it. And he did it. I love the way that he talks about her, because you really don't get that from most rock musicians. They're not usually out there talking about his mom. And he just kept talking about her. It was like, man, she really made a huge impact in his life. I thought that was super cool. For the part about when he talks about Kurt's death, this whole thing was very interesting to me, as far as like, oh man, I can't imagine trying to process things in the way that it was handed to him. Can you talk through that a little bit, about when he got the call in after Kurt's overdose, and when he thought he had died, and what actually happened?
Yeah, but he got the call in the, was he in a hotel, and said that Kurt had passed away. So he hangs up and is processing all that. And then shortly after, he gets another call and said, no, actually he's alive. Like he's going to be okay. He's going to be okay. So he had to very quickly and surprisingly come to terms with the weight of that kind of message over the phone. And then without him even having to process it for too long, it reversed itself. Mm-hmm. So I think it was just like 1 month later that Kurt committed suicide, and he got that call, and how he was just kind of in this suspension of waiting for the second call to come that never came, that said, oh no, he's actually okay. He's going to be all right.
Right.
And how that stunted his ability to grieve and process, because he was still in this purgatory of what to feel.
I can't imagine having that, have it be they're gone. Oh no, they're okay. And then they're actually gone so soon after. And then, like he said, it was almost like he couldn't trigger grief. It was like he was in suspended disbelief, I think is like some way of how he described it. And didn't he say, I mean, he eventually was able to come to terms with it, he said, but not in the way that he wanted. I think he wanted to like deal with it and feel the grief, but he just didn't, because of that false alarm on the first one.
I think he, you know, later in the book, he talks about he was driving his daughter to school, and a Nirvana song came on, and the song was done, and his daughter said, "What was he like? What was Kirk like?" And it just made the impression like that was another moment of healing, where he had to go back and kind of relive it and tell it to his young child, who doesn't have all the context of the drugs, just knowing that he was, you know, in a band with this guy, and then the band is no more.
Yeah.
So I got to believe he's still healing from it, only because of how he read that part of the story chapters later.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's good. When you look at Dave's story and as a whole, like, do you see redemptive elements out of it? He's obviously talking about hard things and grief that he's gone through with the death of Kurt and the death of his best friend. But he talks about a lot of things, and a lot more things than I expected. Was there anything redeeming out of the topics they talked about to you?
Yeah, I think the overarching theme is just gratitude. He doesn't seem to take any of these remarkable things for granted. Fully acknowledges that they're in anybody else's world, they'd be surreal, but for him, it just seems like every day. I mean, he tells the story. Neil Young had a fundraiser for a foundation. And he's invited to this compound and rolls in, and there's no gate. It's just like a Neil sign that says,
yeah.
And rolls in, and there's like a jean jacket on, you know, in the shed, and kids are running around, and he did not have kids yet, but was finally able to reconcile, like, hey, here's a guy who can do the rock and roll thing and have a family. And you know, he has had a million examples of who did it poorly, and he took that one and said, I'm going to adopt that ethos as the Grohl ethos.
I think that's right on. And that specific example is really good too. Cause yeah, I think it was Neil Young's house and it was just like a cardboard sign, like drive to the back or something like that. And he gets in the house and it's like David Crosby's playing guitar and just all these famous people, but the fame is stripped away. They're just hanging cause they have music in common and they appreciate each other and they like hanging out. And yeah, that really does really hammer in the gratitude aspect of it too. Cause you can see how once you're given the possibility of fame and everything is at your doorstep, that you could make bad choices or you make good choices. And it's interesting to hear him kind of verbally process some of the people he looked up to along the way, like some of these guys, and how it helped him land, like you said, in a way that he could actually have a life and have kids and have family and be happy.
I love how you dropped in the David Crosby Easter egg in there. You've got a knack for that.
Have you seen my posts about David Crosby?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, man. For people who haven't followed me, I've interacted with David Crosby a few times on Twitter, and he's written me back, and there was a real close possibility of him coming on this show that got pulled at the very last second. But, man, I think he's awesome, and I would love to chat with him at some point. But he seems like a mythical figure out of the 60s that is still around and interacting with people. And I love him too. So, do you have any final takeaways from the book for people who are thinking about, either listening to it or buying it on and why they should check it out?
I think just do it. I mean, if you ever in your life were a fan of any project that Dave Grohl was a part of, he's an amazing storyteller. I think, you know, just another example of him after Nirvana, the documentaries he's made,
yeah,
the way other people think and speak of him, he just seems like the real deal. So yeah, spend the money for someone else or you know, spend the money for yourself. It was worth every moment.
It's same for me. Definitely enjoyed every part of it. Enjoyed the Audible version too. So Ryan, man, thanks so much for coming on and chatting about Dave Grohl and the book, and love talking music with you, and appreciate you coming on the show today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Songs of Note podcast. Be sure and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. See you next time.